the voice to has now left the heliosphere. They have an instrument on board that can tell how much plasma is coming from the sun. Tell by the direction of the, you know, of how much plasma is coming from the sun as well. And then when they get to a certain point beyond the heliosphere, plasma drops off dramatically, and then what other signals they're getting, or plasma they're getting, is actually from outside the solar system itself, because it's also coming in from a different direction. So they reach that point, start an interview with Ed Stone. Stone's been around, project manager for that, for those two vehicles, all these years, still at it. So he started off young, and now he's not a kid, he's a grandfather and everything. So, very interesting life this guy had. And still has. He's going to follow it for another 10 years or so, they think, before the RTGs drop out, the radioisotope thermoelectric generators that are powering this vehicle. There's three on board, each one. So, there you go. That's the story with Voyager. Officially, it's not leaving the solar system. You know, consider the solar system the Oort cloud. It's taken all these years, 40 years to get from Earth to where it is now, 40 years now. It's going to take roughly 40,000 years to get to the nearest star, roughly 30,000 years just to get past the Oort cloud. And the Oort cloud is the real end of the influence of the gravity for our sun. So you're around 30,000 years from now, you get that. Okay, I was talking about NASA before with the different rockets they're launching all over. Not only our country, NASA launches from now New Zealand, of all places. And this guy built his own launch complex out on the North Island of New Zealand. That's where he's launching his rockets. It's soon to eventually be back in the United States as well. He'll be launching from Wallops Island, Virginia, and he'll still keep launching in New Zealand. But NASA's also involved with other countries. They have a launch complex in Norway. And just last week, NASA had two rockets launched at the same time from this launch complex in northern Norway. It's called the Andoya Space Center. We don't hear much about it, but they've actually launched probably 1,000 rockets from this place over the years. Not orbital, thank God, but they have long-term plans of going orbital. But these are what they call sounding rockets. They just go high up into the atmosphere, 800 miles high, and then come back down. Particular rockets or spacecraft that were on board was to look at the magnetic field. They were called TRICE, TRICE 2, T-R-I-C-E, word rice with a T in front of it. So they are very successful. So pictures of the launch, and they launch on these black brand 12 sounding rockets. Same type of rockets that they launch from, again, from Wallops Island. Wallops Island launches orbital stuff. They launch lunar missions from Wallops Island, Virginia. But they also launch these sounding rockets for many, many decades. That's what they're into. And let's see, another news story earlier in the week, right after the last week met, was that OSIRIS-REx spacecraft that was launched a couple of years ago on an Atlas V rocket with one solid booster attached to it has successfully gotten to its destination, which is an asteroid called Bennu. Bennu is an asteroid that's usually they're out, you know, past Mars or something. This is pretty much close to Earth's orbit behind us. This thing caught up to it, and the goal is to eventually get closer and closer. Just last week it stopped, got within 12 miles, and then with their detectors and everything, they, from that distance, they're able to find signs of water on this particular asteroid. So that's like a big science discovery, if you're really one of the scientists that are involved in the study of asteroids. they believe, of course, that all the water that we have here on Earth was had to come from somewhere, and they think it came from a lot of the asteroid impacts. And they're always out to prove it. So they found traces of hydrogen and oxygen molecules on Bennu. Helped solidify their science theory. Wait long enough to 2023. OSIRIS-REx, the main spacecraft, will be sending a small capsule through our atmosphere to the deserts of Utah, where it will be picked up, and they're going to open it up, and they're going to find whatever this spacecraft, OSIRIS-REx, has collected from Bennu. It's going to take that many years to bring it back. Actually, it's going to take another year or so before they actually get the substance from the asteroid. And then from there on, it will leave that orbit and come back to Earth in 2023. Okay, I don't know if anybody watched NASA TV during the week, but they had a great almost 8-hour spacewalk. And not by the Americans, by the Russians, on the International Space Station. Their goal was to look on the outside of one of the Soyuz spacecraft that are attached to the space station right now. Right now there's two spacecraft, manned spacecraft attached to the ISS. That's because each one carries three people. You have six people on board. And then there's also two other spacecraft that Russia has, Progress spacecraft, that are also docked to the space station, as well as Dragon, one of our own, is still attached, as well as the Cygnus spacecraft. So you have six ports that are occupied, really only two left that are unoccupied. But I found the spacewalk interesting. Two Russians went outside, and the goal is to look on the outside of one of the Soyuz spacecraft. They wanted to find remnants of this hole that they had found a couple of months ago that was drilled from the inside out with a 2-millimeter drill bit. And, they realized it was there in the first place because there was an air leak. And they noticed that the air was kind of dropping slowly, but dropping all the same. So what they did is actually the Russians went in there and they sealed it with an epoxy, a gauze of an epoxy. They pushed it through the hole, and they figured it came out on the other side. Their goal was to take a look on the other side. They wanted to see what this looks like. You gotta remember, this spacecraft is eventually gonna bring back three people Thursday back to Earth, and they wanna make sure everything's okay and safe. So the two Russians go out, and they have their own robotic arm. They weren't using our 57-foot Canadian-built robotic arm that's permanently attached to the International Space Station. They have their own arm. They're called Streller arm. Streller is Russian for arrow. It kind of looks like an arrow. And the way it operates is pretty much manually by one guy down below. One, EVA astronaut. The other guy gets attached to the other end of this. And they actually, two of these robotic arms, they want to get to one location, and then another robotic arm set up to get to the outside of this orbital section of the Soyuz spacecraft. Soyuz spacecraft consists of three different pieces. You have the vent and reentry module, that's in the middle. And then right behind it, you have the service module, which has rockets, retro rockets, maneuvering rockets, and has fuel, and has water, and everything, power that that you need to, for a spacecraft. And then at the very front, there's this other module, and that's called the orbital module. And that's the one that they, when they leave the descent module, they float around as the orbital module, and they hang out there. There's a little bit more room. It's very cramped if you've ever seen a launch of one of these Soyuz spacecraft. And there's more room. They have a bathroom there and all, and you can float around. And they also have a docking port there, and that's how they get into the International Space Station and back out. Well, that's the location where this hole was, right behind where the little many bathrooms would be located. And they found a hole and they pocketed it. Now, this astronaut goes outside to, his goal is to look at it. Now, covering the outside of the aluminum hull, what the frame is made of, they have to get to that hull from on the outside. On the outside, they have this heavy, thick, black insulation. Looks like about 3 or 4 inches thick. Looks pretty thick. And then below that, they have this micrometeorite shield covering the whole, you know, surface of the spacecraft. And they had to peel away this insulation and cut away this micrometeorite shield. To do that, they bought these, let's call them scissors, but they look like big snips. And as one of the Russians was trying to cut this away neatly and everything, every time he pushed against the spacecraft, he would push himself away. He couldn't hold himself tight enough, even with the robotic arm that they were using. You know, the other guy that was out there came up and was helping him. He came up the pole, really, that's what looked like a pole, and he jumped his way all the way up to where he was located. Two of them were up there trying to cut through this insulation. And whatever they tried wasn't working. It was going nowhere fast. So they used this, they called it the knife. Well, knife. It looks like, this thing looks like a sheetrock knife. You've ever cut through sheetrock in your home. They make a regular sheetrock knife with these big teeth on it. And, you're able to cut right through sheetrock. That's what this thing looked like. And he was out there, and he's pushing like a madman. I mean, there were pieces of insulation flying off the spacecraft. I mean, floating through space. I mean, hundreds of pieces of insulation. He was going nuts and having a hard time. But he felt this is the best system. This snipping away wasn't working. With that, his Barnum out there, he looking up at him, and he told him, he was worried about it. He says, honestly, he goes, now he says it's in Russian. I can't look at that. Kogolev. He says, it's my vehicle. Oleg is the guy cutting it apart. He just knows it's his vehicle. He's going back in this thing. What are you doing? Their original plan was to put more insulation back on, but they don't need to do that because this orbital section does not come back to Earth with them. So with that, he finally gets the insulation off, and then he's got these snips. Now, the snips worked out okay for the micrometeorite shield, which looks like heavy-duty tin. That's what it looks like when he's cutting it off. I'm not sure what it's made of. It's probably, my guess, is aluminum. Touch of titanium in there for strength, I don't know. But he cut that away, and they knew exactly where to cut away. It's 10 by 10-inch section. Eventually, he saw this little black area, very small, and that was the epoxy that had extruded through the hole, and it had these special snips with it, and he was able to cut it apart. That was the goal. They wanted to cut whatever epoxy that they have, bring it back inside, and eventually send it back, on a Dragon spacecraft, and have their scientists look at this stuff. One of the reasons for it is they've never really confirmed who drilled this hole. Was it done accidentally? Was it done on purpose? The Russians just don't know. There's plenty of pictures of the hole on the inside, and now they have pictures of what it looks like on the outside. Like I said before, when it goes back to Earth on this Thursday, middle of the night, they're not really too worried about it. You're going to have these three people on board, one German, one American lady, and commander from Russia flying this thing back, and hopefully they get back to Kazakhstan safe on their parachute. They don't need this section, the orbital section, and that back section with all the rockets, retro rockets and fuel and batteries and things that they don't need, solar panels. That eventually separates. That separates, and the orbital section that they just drilled through also separates at the exact same time. And right after you separate, the descent module, which the three people will be in, turns at a certain angle, and eventually starts slowing down when it starts hitting the atmosphere. They get closer to the Earth, the parachute opens up, and hopefully they're able to land on the surface. Right before the surface, they land on the surface. There's little retro rockets, there's four of them that go off, soften the blow as they hit the surface. So that's the story on that EVA. So let's see if anybody has any comments or questions. A few more topics here. Does anybody have any questions at this time? This is WS2N. Okay, we covered the InSight landing quite a bit. That's a spacecraft that's now sitting roughly on the equator of Mars. And it's doing quite well. Solar panels opened up. The camera is working. Great pictures are coming back, including a series of 11 pictures that InSight took of itself. So they stitched all these pictures together and they came out with a selfie of what this thing looks like sitting on the surface. And they've improved quite a bit. Any of these selfie-type pictures that you've seen on Opportunity, one of the rovers, or Spirit, or now Curiosity. Pictures never looked that good to me. You can tell what it is, but it just doesn't look that good. It's all out of whack. But this one is pretty good. So I thought that was okay. We cover foreign spacecraft here as well. We cover the launch of Chang 4. Chang 4 is a spacecraft that's going to the moon, built and flown by China. And launched, a week or two ago. The idea was to eventually get into a lunar orbit. It has now successfully done that, and eventually will be changing the highly inclined orbit that it has now to a circular orbit. That should be within a couple of weeks. So they think in the beginning of January sometime that this thing will be eventually landing on the dark side of the moon. Has a lander. On the lander, it has a rover. And I know we covered it last week, probably the week before, but rover and lander start doing their thing on the dark side of the moon. They'll be transmitting up to a relay satellite that was put there in the beginning of the year by China. So that satellite is staying at 60,000 kilometers away from the moon in one location, so it's like not orbiting the moon, it's just looking at the dark side all the time. But at the same time, it's far enough away where it can see Earth at the same time, so you'll be able to transmit from the moon to satellites and back to Earth and the other way around as well. So that Mission Control in China could direct this sequence. There are going to be three different steps to get this thing to land, and then once it gets to the point where radio signals won't be able to Earth designed to work autonomously all the way down to the surface. Three more different moves for landing. So, going to give it a shot, and if they succeed, they'll be the first country or entity to ever land on the dark side of the moon. Okay, one other quick topic I just wanted to cover is Boca Chica, the location in Texas. Boca Chica is going to be a launch complex built by Elon Musk and SpaceX. He's been at this for years. He eventually wants to be able to launch his heavy vehicle from that location, which could eventually be the same vehicle that eventually goes to Mars. He's building this thing many years, getting the soil ready, and getting gigantic 80-foot antennas there, and setting this whole place up. He's going to set up a large solar panel field to power this place. Interesting location. But now he's running into a little problem with our government. He's talking about eventually putting a wall from one end of our country to the other. He's trying to cut off Mexico. And the location of this guy's launch complex is right along that border. So they they would have to, take his land, and that would foul him up for, his infrastructure and everything that he's doing. So he's going to have a problem with the federal government if they ever really wanted to build that wall. He's got a great location, but all of a sudden this eminent domain type of thing is coming into effect. We'll see how that goes. I don't think he's going to have a problem. This is WS. One topic I haven't covered yet, which is important, is the Virgin Galactic Spaceship 2. That took off on the aircraft carrier. It's a carrier jet called the White Knight 2. It's got these jet engines on it, and it carries this spacecraft, they call it a Spaceship 2, up to 45,000 feet. You have two people on board, a pilot and co-pilot, and they dropped it from the carrier jet, and it lit off its engine and took off. They've done this before, about three different times. Now, this is each time they increase the amount of time that the rocket fires. This time, they were able to go a little longer, around 60 seconds. The last time was 45 seconds. And that got them to a height of 55 miles above the ground. Yeah. According to NASA, NASA considers the space limit 50 miles. And other different groups and agencies consider it to be the common line, which is 62 miles. So based on that, they're 12 miles, around 10 miles short. But not as far as that NASA is concerned. If you're above 50 miles, you're good enough. You're considered an astronaut. So the pilots, Mark Stuckey and CJ Strucko is now officially astronauts. And what that does for this country, anyway, is, since the last space shuttle that went up, STS-135, which was Atlantis, that was in summer of 2011. All these years now, we haven't had anybody leave the surface and go into space. All right, it's not orbital, it's suborbital. Go up, and then they come back down and land on a runway. But it is space, so it's actually reversed that. It stopped that clock from ticking on any further. So 2011 to now, we actually have two astronauts that left the surface of, it was actually California, Mojave Space Center, and they launched from there and came back and landed on the ground. NASA also had four experiments on board Spaceship 2. So along with the two astronauts, they had four experiments that NASA is doing studies on. So I thought that was pretty interesting. And that's pretty much it. I want to mention this one thing that they have attached to the National Space Station called the Total Spectral Solar Irradiance Center, TSIS. There's an extra S in there, but for some reason they call it TSIS. And what this gadget does was, it was brought up the end of last year, 2017. Brought up by a Dragon cargo vehicle, and it was in the unpressurized area in the back of the cargo vehicle. When they eventually berthed the spacecraft to the ISS, they had the Canadian robot arm reach out behind the spacecraft in what they call the trunk section and disconnected TSIS from the Dragon, and they attached it permanently to the International Space Station. What this thing does, it looks at the sun, 24 hours a day. Well, not 24 hours a day. The ISS goes into darkness every now and then. It sees 16 days for every one day that we see. So when it's looking at the sun, it's taking measurements of the sun. It knows exact temperature out for them. The sun does change now and then. And they've actually been taking these readings like for the last 50 years, but now this is more precise. This is now permanently located on the space station. So what they really need to do is they're trying to figure out this loss that we really have for Earth with all this global warming. They know how much is being radiated from Earth at any given time. One given time might be a certain amount, it might be less, it might be more, but they say it doesn't help to know that unless they know the exact amount of heat that's entering the Earth. With this gadget, they know that. And it's going to help scientists in the long run to really work on the global warming problem out there. So that's the story on that. And that's pretty much it. Dick, or anybody else who has any questions or comments for the space portion of the TechNet, this is WS2N. I'll be here.
Yeah, WS2N, KD2PBFO, with a question about the bulk of chief.
Okay. You call one by pretty quick, and then the question was about, and then I missed it. You cut out the very end. This is Paul, WS2N. What's your name and call again? Okay. I heard nothing that time. Anybody have a comment or a question? Okay, I guess not. Dick, if you have any comments or questions, I'm here. If not, we can always go back to AC2GS, K2RIW, WS2N.
The Parker probe is the one that's probing the sun. I'm wondering how many more orbits are going to be required before they figure out why chronosphere, millions of degrees, whereas the surface below that only thousands of degrees. Where is all that extra heating coming from? They've had their first close flyby into the solar corona. They've gathered some data, and what they've reported so far leads me to believe they don't have an answer to that yet. Is that true, Paul?
Yeah, they're just working on it. You know, the first pass was just this past late November. The Parker went there. Pretty close to the sun. And each time it goes around the sun, every year, it's going to get it, you know, closer and closer until it gets to the point where it will be, what, 3.7 million miles from the surface of the sun. That will be the closest point. And I think that's 4 or 5 years down the road. But now I think they got up to 25 million, or under 25 million. They beat the record of the Helios. Back in the 1970s, we had the Helios spacecraft. They blew that away. And, of course, with all the instruments on it, I'm sure the scientists got plenty of information. But, yeah, I'll always be curious to find out that answer. You know, the sun is, you know, pick a number, 10,000 degrees, and then, well, you know, why is the chronosphere, you know, a million degrees? I remember one of Carl Sagan's books, he said that one of the possibilities is, you know, do have some kind of an atmosphere gravitationally attached, you know, because of the sun. And whatever's coming off the sun, maybe even sound waves are coming from and hitting this thing at such a velocity. It could be a solar wind, you know, all kinds of theory. Whatever it is could be hitting this atmosphere at such a fast pace that might be making the chronosphere hot, you know. So, but yeah, still unanswered, and that's probably going to be one of the biggest discoveries for astronomy or astro science, you know, probably in decades once they get that answer. Back to you, Dick.
K2CX.
K2CX, go ahead.
Well, I guess it may take those fellas that figured that the summer's going to be burning out, make them lean back a bit and rethink that.
Yeah, well, I don't think it's going to change. I think we still got, what, 5 billion years left, something like that. But it's been lit for 5 billion, and I think they got another 5 billion more. And even then, I think it goes down to a white dwarf or something. It might gobble up the Earth and even Mars as a red giant, but you know, a trillion years from now, the sun will be gone. I don't know. Back to you.
Problem is understanding the time clocks all involved. I say good evening. I'm going to assign myself to listening for a while, and Dick Theodore, K2CX, open clip.
Okay. My best guess is that the sound waves making that much heat, boy, that's a tough one. I think there is some kind of a radiation coming from the sun. It's hard for me to believe it's neutrinos, but there's some kind of a radiation where the photosphere is reasonably transparent to it, and the layer above that, I all of a sudden can't think of the layer, but the chronosphere is opaque to it, and it's absorbing those particles and turning them into heat. Amazing that they haven't discovered that one yet. During a total solar eclipse, when the moon is in front of the sun from our point of view, and you see just the corona, extremely bright object, but optically it's reasonably transparent, and you don't see it under normal circumstances. So, quite a mystery. And on top of that, the solar wind coming off the sun, on average, is what, 1 or 2 million degrees? It's close to 1 million miles an hour, the solar particles, the solar wind coming off the sun, boiling off. That's an awful high velocity. Let me drop. The Parker went inside of the Mercury orbit to get down as low as it did. Is it one-third of the distance of the sun? In other words, how much closer is Parker to the sun compared to Mercury? Do we have some easy numbers to remember on that one, Paul? WS2N, K2IW?
Mercury's close. You know, 36 million miles. So this thing went, I think, 125 million. So it got in there pretty good. So that gives you a good idea, I think. So, I'm amazed the spacecraft is going to be able to survive this, even so the atmosphere is very rarefied. That's why they say sound waves. The sound waves, you wouldn't hear anything, but the sound could be pushing a volume of air or gas down the surface so powerful that, it just, when it goes up, it pushes all these other molecules from the sun all the way up to the chronosphere. About 3 million miles away. It sounds like a long shot, but it's one of the theories, and it could be solar wind, that solar wind is actually hitting the chronosphere. But they do realize there is some kind of an atmosphere. That's why the Parker spacecraft is not going to burn up. It's going to be a million degree temperature, but Parker will be fine. It's got heavy insulation and everything, but those molecules will be moving at such a pace that they're equivalent to a million degrees, but there aren't enough molecules. The volume is not there to actually do net damage to the spacecraft. I mean, if we had the same density of air at that location, the chronosphere we had here, it wouldn't survive. A million degrees wouldn't make it. But if you take all those atoms and you rarefy it, that's the reason that the spacecraft is going to survive. So those atoms.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
To a million degrees. I think they'll find out. Might take a couple of years. Back to you.
Got to turn on the L tone. Getting Parker down to its lower altitudes, closer to the sun, is a lot more difficult than first meets the eye. Let me give you a couple of words on this. If I've got a satellite 25,000 miles above the surface of the Earth, a geosynchronous orbit up there real high, that satellite is moving around the Earth at something like 6,000 miles an hour. When I bring that satellite down to a lower orbit, a low Earth orbit, the satellite is moving 17,500 miles an hour. So a low Earth orbit, you move faster. A high Earth orbit, you're a larger radius, but you move slower. That's the central force motion, space dynamics, so to speak. So anything you do to start off in a high orbit and go to a low orbit, you're going to gain velocity. So the Parker spacecraft started off at the Earth's radius away from the sun. It wants to go down below Mercury's radius away from the sun. So you're moving down to a lower orbit around the sun. You're going to gain a tremendous amount of velocity. And you have to dissipate an awful lot of that energy. Could, to use Roy's earlier vocabulary, that is an exothermic reaction. You have to give up energy to get Parker down to a lower orbit. And they're doing that by multiple flybys of Earth, Venus, Mercury, by various kinds of flyby, depending on which side of a satellite, which side of a planet you pass. You either get whipped into a higher energy or a lower energy. Well, they're doing these multiple passes to get down to a lower energy to get it closer. There's two ways of doing it. A whole lot of rocket blasting. They didn't have the fuel on board to do it, or these fancy maneuvers. So getting Parker down to a lower orbit is taking them what?
Repeater, timeout.
I think it's taking them a total of, what is it, something like 25 orbits to get down there, Paul, where they're losing a little bit of energy on each one of those orbits. And so I guess to some people it's kind of difficult to see why didn't they go down to that low orbit right away? Well, they want to go down to a low orbit at a reasonable velocity so that they dwell long enough to make these measurements. So that's what I think is going on. I think it's going to take them some large number of orbits around the sun to finally get down to the altitude they want to get over to. WS2N, K2IW.
Yeah, well, they plan on 7 years, you know, but, you know, NASA, if they can get more out of it, they will. 7 years each time, getting lower and lower. Now, it's not a circular orbit, you know, like you said, they're going to go out to the orbit of roughly Venus, and each time they do that, it's going to change the velocity and the angle that they're going in on, and then each time get closer and closer until they work their way into 3.7 million miles from the surface, roughly 7 years from now. But yeah, they don't want to stay there too long. They don't want to be at a circular orbit. They want to take all the measurements, you know, point the spacecraft right at the sun. The spacecraft has these, like, let's call them heat sensors, four of them, looking at the sun. So if any one of them starts to see a little too much light or too much heat, it knows to adjust it. So it's all autonomous, you know, it will adjust itself. It'll change the angle. So that, you know, this way they always have it, carbon-carbon, 4-inch thick shield in front of them, protecting it. But then they move into a cooler area, you know, start going out to Venus, and, you know, they're able to take all the data, a lot of data. It's a forward type of system. A lot of data will go in, and then when they're in a cooler area, it'll transmit back to Earth. You know, relocate the attitude of the spacecraft where the antenna is now pointing toward Earth, and then send the signals and all the information back, and this will go on and on year after year. But, you know, that's why they need that big rocket. They sent it off with NASA's biggest rocket, the Delta III. Three Delta boosters, you know, both side by side. This thing was sitting at the top of the middle one. And when that thing took off, it was only, you know, only what, 1,600 pound spacecraft or something like that. This massive rocket, they needed that speed to actually slow itself down. Well, we're traveling around the sun at 60,000 miles per hour. Earth is anyway. And you've got to decrease that speed tremendously to get closer and closer to the sun. You've got to bleed off maybe 40,000 miles per hour.
I'm going to change subject for a minute. Virgin Galactic had a success where they're up to what they're calling space, which I think is 51 miles, as I remember. It's not 100 kilometers, which would be 62 miles. But various people have a different definition of space. But I think I read that his passengers that are going to be taking these space flights, I think they're going to pay $250,000 per passenger. And I think there's something like 200 people who have already signed up for that trip. And that's just one of these guys flying these space missions. Can you imagine spending $250,000 for a trip to so-called outer space, and you're going to be there for a total of 2 minutes? Dollars per minute. Wow. Over you, Paul. W. S. Stewart. 200 people have already signed up for that. Over you, Paul. KQLIW.
Yeah, he's got 600 people. They're not new people. This is from years ago. And they were all still signed up for that price, $250,000. And he's not taking anybody else until he bleeds through all these people. He's got this spaceship, too, that he built and finished. It's called Unity. He has two more he's working on right now. He thinks one will be eventually ready by the end of next year. And another one after that, and then he's got two more planned, so he'll have a fleet of five, and he'll be able to take off from different places around the world. After this thing is okayed, right now he's in Mojave, California, doing the test, he's going to move to a place called Spaceport America in New Mexico, and that's where he's got a place in reserve. Spaceport America is a launch complex by the state of Mexico, paid a lot of money in taxes to build that. So that's where he's going to go off from, $250,000. Now, on the chat room, we were talking about this other vehicle that goes down into the water called Cyclops 2. And it successfully made it down to 13,000 feet last week. The owner, I guess, went down in it. And eventually, you're going to have five people to be able to go on that. And that's only going to cost you $150,000. So that might be a bit of a bargain and more of a thrill to go down and visit the Titanic. That's what his plans are to do. This one company. Back to you, Derek.
I guess it's a good sign that we've got so many people in the United States that don't know what to do with their money. 600 people have signed up for $250,000 to go to space for a couple of minutes. What some of those people don't realize that of all these well-trained astronauts, one of the best-kept secrets is that 50% on average of the astronauts that go into space spend the first 24 or 48 hours with space sickness, literally throwing up. So half of all astronauts get sick when they first get to space. Even some of the ones that they're on their third trip, and the first two they didn't get sick, and the third one they do, it's not thoroughly predictable. So of all these 600 people that are going to go to space for $250,000, a significant percentage of them are going to get sick. They're not even going to be able to look out the window and see what they've paid for. They're going to make sure they aim to the throw-up bag that's with them. A certain percentage of them, granted, of the people who get sick, who get space sick, maybe it takes an hour to happen. Maybe it doesn't happen during the first few minutes, so there I'm not sure. But some of those people are not going to get their money's worth. But even those who get their money's worth, they're going to be in space for 2 minutes. That's $125,000 per minute to be in space. Who are you, Paul? KQLIW.
Yeah, but that's the only way to do it, I mean, just to qualify, you could go to the space station, pay the Russians. NASA's paying the Russians. I think it's up to $80 million now, $80 million per astronaut every time we send somebody up with them. So an individual that was paying by themselves, I think they're cheaper for some reason. They probably get away with $50 or $60 million. So that's really big money. But, you might be able to get to go up to 10 days. Nine people have done that so far, nine paying people. Starting with Dennis Tito originally. And is it worth it? If you got billions of dollars, I guess, I guess it is. What would you rather do, though? Go on a Cyclops down to visit the Titanic or go into orbit? Forget about suborbital. Would you go up for 10 days in orbit? Say it was the same price, I think I might gamble with the Titanic. I think you know, one day it's over.
Both of them have an awful lot of danger, Paul. So you gotta go slow. Okay, we've run out of time. I think this was TechNet number 1726, but maybe it's 25 or 27. I know I'm one number off from you. But we'll be back next week. 73, you all. Thanks an awful lot from Roy and Paul and all the guys that participated tonight. Boy, we had a lot more participation than usual. 73, you all. Back to Roy if he wants to say any final comments. And I think we've got to use as a puzzle next week, Jeff, why you feel cold when you get out of the shower and your body is still a little bit wet.
Repeater, time out. Repeater, time out. Cancel.
There's a lot more to that than first meets the eye. AC2GS for any other comments? K2Rise up here. Go ahead, Roy.
Okay, very good, Dick, and we'll be back to do this all over again next week and try and come up with interesting puzzles. I was pleased that people engaged with the subject, and I hope they had a little bit of fun. In addition to the link at roy.ac2gs for all the chemical reactions that go on in the human body and a little article about that, the FDA asking you please don't eat the glitter, I also included a very nice YouTube about how magnetic logic works and how to get hysteresis loss to work for you. It's a great little YouTube video, and I hope you click on it and enjoy it. Once again, if you have any kind of topics, the address is mailbag@ac2gs.com, and the website for the links is roy.ac2gs.com. Once again, thanks to Dick, thanks to Paul, thanks to everyone who participated, and even those who just listened. And we'll try and do it all over again next week. 73, and I'm going clear.
Roy, have a good night. You too, Dick. And my numbers are SpaceNet 328, and I got TechNet 1728, and I got FindStalk 57. But give or take one or two, who cares? But that's what we got. Have a good night, guys. WS1. We'll be clear. Till next week.
Bye bye, you all.
The time is 12:04 a.m. 73. And good night from the W2VL repeater. W2VL Amateur Radio Repeater System. Net tonight at 8:30 W2VL Repeater System. Radio, repeater, system. W2VL repeater.
time no speak. Enter we go. How are you?
Okay, pretty good. As you noticed, we got Echolink working last night during the TechNet, but I had to put Joshua to sleep, so I missed the end of the TechNet, but it's been hasn't been working all this time. Just got it working last night, and now it's working pretty good. I think. I haven't checked it out very carefully, but I think it's working better than it ever. What's going on in New York? We're getting ready to take the kids to school soon, so I'm not going to stay on very long.
Okay, Barry. I haven't heard you on. What happened with your phone? I tried call. You know, I don't have a phone right now. Mine, it got liquid in it. Thought it was something. Verna took it to Metro PCS. They said it cannot be repaired. But she's buying me a new phone. Christmas. I'm getting an S9 by Samsung. Good phone.
Okay, well, you can use a new phone. Sounds like that's going to work. That'll be good. Christmas. That's not too many days away. And we now have Echolink, so I can talk to you. I can't talk to you on the phone, but I can talk to you on Echolink. Unless you have another number I could call, then I can call you. My phone will be working tomorrow. I've been waiting because I'm too cheap to spend the extra $5. So I said, screw it. I'll let it go till tomorrow, and then I'll turn it on.
Barry, what was the hang-up? Your phone was off.
Simple hang-up. I didn't have the money to put it back on, but I will by tomorrow, and it'll be back on. I could have gotten it on, but I wanted to use the plan because the plan is $5 cheaper, unlimited. So I said, we'll get back to that. So that's what hung the phone up. But Echolink was another story. Echolink, the computer crashed weeks ago already, and it was a convoluted problem. Sammy got through it. He figured it out last night. We didn't even know if it was working or not. But last night, we tried to put the computer on and get into LimeOS and all that stuff, and it couldn't get into LimeOS, but it was working. Anyway, we got all the bugs out of it, as you can see. So I'm on the radio, and I'll be on the phone by tonight. But tomorrow. Tomorrow, I'll be on the phone as well.
Okay, Barry, N2MB and 2EO. If you tried calling me, what did you get?
On the phone or the radio? Which are you talking about?
On the phone.
Yeah, I didn't hear a thing, Richie. If I tried calling you on what?
Ed. Did he try calling me on the phone? My phone doesn't work, so what'd you get? Oh, Barry, where'd you go?
That was a computer glitch. I don't know. I'm back. I just had to reestablish the connection. If I tried calling you on what? On Echolink? On the phone? What were you talking about? I missed all of that.
Did you try call me on the phone? And what did you get?
I don't think you're hearing me, Richie. I don't have a phone. I won't have a phone until tomorrow. I haven't had a phone for weeks. 3 weeks already.